Welcome to the New Books in History podcast. I'm Christine Lamberson, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, I'm speaking with Akinyeye Umoja, who is a professor and chair of the Department of the African American Studies at Georgia State University. We will be speaking about his new book, We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. This book was published by New York University Press in 2013. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Christine. And it's Akinyeye.
Thank you. Sorry for my mispronunciations there. I wondered if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and where you're from and how you came to be a scholar and a historian.
Wow, that's a long story. But I'm originally born in Los Angeles, California. My parents both have interest in histories as far as I'm concerned. But my father was a minister. He actually was a sharecropper when he grew up in the Mississippi Delta. And some of the inspiration from the book comes from the fact that he was a sharecropper. But he told me a story when he was a young man that he saw a black man's body hanging from a water tower. A black man had been lynched. And my grandfather went to get a rifle to shoot the first white person he saw after seeing this black man's body who had been lynched. And the family tackled my grandfather and disarmed him because they were fearful that the whole family would be lynched and my grandfather had retaliated. But hearing this story as a young person, it kind of, I was interested because I never heard of blacks in the South. Growing up in California during the time I grew up, and I'm 60 years old now. I was born in 1954. So I lived during most of my youth was during the civil rights and the Black Power era, but I never heard of blacks in the South resisting, particularly with guns. And so I was intrigued by that. But on the other hand, I understood the fear and intimidation the family felt. So that's part of what drives the story. The book was the story of black people overcoming their oppressors, but breaking the fear to be able to do that. And what role did guns and armed resistance play in that? So that's what inspires part of the book. But going back to myself and how I became a scholar, I really see myself as a scholar activist. As I said, I'm a child of the civil rights and Black Power movement. And so that sort of inspired me when I graduated from high school to get involved in the movement, even first as a student activist. But, you know, at a point I drop out of school and become more active in the community, in community activism. But then people in the movement kept on encouraging me, particularly because I used to write a lot in movement publications. You need to go back to school. You need to get credentials. You need to teach things of that nature. And so particularly as I became a husband and a father and needed to make an income, it's something I like to do. It encouraged me to go back to school, get my credentials. And I guess being a part of the student movement, African-American or Black Studies was a nice home for me to exist in since that field of study was started through student activism. And so that kind of, in a nutshell, how I got to the place I'm at today.
Okay. And so you had an interest in this topic even before you became a scholar. So
Most definitely. There's some other, even other than the story about my father. Uh-huh. When I was a student activist, I visited the South. I was a part of a student organization. And there were two people I met, Dara Abubakari. She's also known as Virginia Collins. She was a member of the Republic of New Africa. She was a child of Garvey Ates. And her son, Walter Collins, who was a member of SNCC and was a war resistor during the Vietnam War era. But they started telling me stories when I met them in Atlanta and I was riding with them to New Orleans about black people being armed and when they had nonviolent demonstrations, black people being bystanders with weapons to protect the nonviolent folk. They talked about weapons being buried in rural areas in case it was that type of a need for this arsenal that you know activists were hiding and so or concealing. And so I just never heard these stories. And so when I went to graduate school, I decided to write a paper about it. And one of my professors said, "Man, that would make a great dissertation." So that's how I get started.
Okay.
Idea. As well as one other thing, I met activists. So my chapter 8 looks at the United League of Mississippi, and I was actually able to meet people in that organization and visited Mississippi during that time and interacted with folks. So some of the things I talked about in that chapter, I actually witnessed.
That's great. So did you do a lot of interviews for this project, or how did you go about finding the information, and what sort of research did you do?
Oral history was essential because a lot of this wasn't documented in other secondary works that's been done. But the problem is, you know, if you get one story, then you got to get that corroborated. So I did a significant amount of oral history, some to corroborate the oral testimony of others. And then finally, I looked at surveillance records of people in the movement. I looked at the COINTELPRO documents of people in the movement. I looked at newspapers and other sources I could get to corroborate the oral testimony, as well as records of organizations. So I looked extensively at the records of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress of Racial Equality, as well as the NAACP and South.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what you found when you got into this research and you got into actually looking at the records, doing the formal oral histories and all of that kind of research. So your book makes an argument that armed resistance is much more important than what we normally think about of most of the stories we hear about the Black freedom struggle in Mississippi. And I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about the role of armed resistance in the lives of Black Mississippians, as well as in the freedom struggle. And it seems to me, of course, that role changes over time, that maybe we could start with the early 1960s, the sort of period when we normally think about the movement as being characterized mostly by nonviolence.
Okay. And I would agree, nonviolence actually as a practice in the Black struggle, it really emerges in the 1940s with Congress for Racial Equality. But it doesn't come to the South until it's practiced in the Montgomery bus boycott in the 50s. But it doesn't come to Mississippi to 1961. Prior to that in Mississippi, the movement kind of emerges really in the early 1950s with a group called the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. And that organization was headed by a Black man, a doctor by the name of T.R.M. Howard. And Dr. Howard would always have a group of people around him who were armed. Number one, he was one of the wealthiest Black men in Mississippi, so he could afford armed security that he paid for. But he also had people in the community who were willing to protect him. And he finally would carry guns himself, sometimes that he would conceal because he was concerned about being disarmed, by even though it was legal to carry arms. But he was concerned about being arms taken away from him so he wouldn't be able to protect himself. One of Dr. Howard's lieutenants was Megger Evers, who was also known to be armed. Megger Evers, though, would oftentimes, particularly after he became a national representative of the NAACP in the state, or the state representative paid by the national NAACP, he was more conciliatory about his carrying a weapon, so he didn't talk about it as much. But some of the nonviolent activists I interviewed said that Megger Evers would say they were crazy if they weren't armed. But that just shows in the early 50s there was a practice of carrying arms. In the 1960s, in 1961, you have Robert Moses, the legendary activist who was the first proclaimed nonviolent activist who would come to Mississippi. And oftentimes there was a little tension, at least early on, between Bob and some of the local activists indigenous activists there. One particular man by the name of E.W. Steptoe, who Bob and Mr. Steptoe would get into these debates about whether Mr. Steptoe should be armed or not. And Bob thought that, you know, he wanted a debate, but Mr. Steptoe just didn't talk about it anymore and hid the guns from Bob. But that, I think Bob found out after a while that you had to, particularly SNCC's strategy following from the great Ella Baker of relying upon the local population and taking leadership from them. He found that they had to rely upon local people for their protection, number one, but also that local people weren't going to change and local people weren't necessarily going to be nonviolent. As Bob would say, when I interviewed him, he said local people carried the day. And so they carried the day in terms of how guns were going to be used and what role they were going to have in the movement in Mississippi. And actually in Mississippi, there wasn't a lot of nonviolent direct action. There was some, excuse me, but there was a lot of concentration on organizing communities and preparing people to participate in voter registration efforts. So it wasn't the same amount of demonstrations that you might have seen in other places, but more emphasis on organizing. And because of that, most of the self-defense was emphasized on protecting people's homes. I thought I had turned that off. Protecting people's homes, protecting individuals in the movement, and protecting institutions like churches and other institutions, the Freedom Houses and other institutions of the movement. And so even enterprises, there were certain entrepreneurs who would support the movement. For instance, in Macomb, Mississippi, you had a woman who had a restaurant and she allowed movement people to eat there for free. So those type of institutions were protected by community folk.
And would you say that this armed resistance was effective?
Oh, most definitely. I argued that the organizers would not have been able to organize around voter registration they would have been driven out of town without the armed resistance. I also argue this in the book, that after 1964 in Mississippi, there's a change. Prior to that, people were more conciliatory about the carrying of guns. But after 1964, people are more open. In fact, there's an advocacy of armed resistance that takes place after 1964. And so there's a change in that. And I think that advocacy, to some way, as well as the addition of maybe paramilitary organization in some places, would combine with economic boycotts, I think were most effective in making racial and cultural change in Mississippi.
Okay. I want to talk some more about those, but before we do, I was wondering if you might talk a little bit more about those tensions between the nonviolent organizations and the local activists. I mean, as you say, the local sort of carry the day. But how do you see the effects of those tensions long term on these organizations?
Actually, long term, I think that the organizations were transformed. So they weren't exclusively nonviolent. And when I say the organizations, we're specifically talking about the Congress of Racial Equality and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which were nonviolent organizations, right? The NAACP never was really a nonviolent organization. In fact, even prior to what we classically call the Civil Rights Movement, they had supported Black people who had defended themselves. They had legal support and other support of Black folks who had defended themselves. And many of the leaders of local level people in NAACP carry guns, and it was the way they live. But SNCC and CORE were nonviolent organizations. But what began to happen is, number one, after the initial tension, they began to rely on local people for protection. And that protection you know, they kind of relaxed their stance, at least in terms of local people. But then you also began to have within the organization, both organizations, debates about whether they should be nonviolent or not, or members should carry guns or not. So, for instance, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1964, you have a debate in June in that organization about whether organizers should carry guns or not. And they went back and forth. Some felt they should carry guns or they should not, because they felt that that would invite more repression and they might lose any support they might have from liberals up north or the government if they knew they had guns. Others argued that there were death threats on members of the organization, on local people, and if they didn't arm themselves, they would be wiped out, and the federal government had shown itself unwilling to protect members of the movement. So it was a debate in the organization. It came down to one member of the organization asking a question. This man's name is Charles Cobb, and who's recently written a book on this question of armed self-defense in the movement called That Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. Okay, but Charles Cobb asked the question, what would happen if a SNCC member is in a room or in a house, excuse me, and the Klan attacks the house, they kill the local male leader and his wife and daughter in the house, and the gun's laying there and the Klan is coming in the house. Would I be expelled from SNCC if I pick up this gun and defend Mr. Steptoe's family or Mr. Turnbull's family or whoever that might be? The room was kind of silent. It was kind of tense. Then the great Ella Baker said, she intervenes and said, if SNCC would expel Charles Cobb for defending Mr. Steptoe's family, it's not the organization I thought it would be. So that was a kind of a critical point in this debate. So the organization didn't reject nonviolence, but it was an embrace again of self-defense. That the same thing happened in Congress with racial equality. I think my argument is their interaction with people there on the ground, who that's how they're surviving day to day. It has an influence on these younger activists in the organization. And so I think it transforms both groups. And I think that's what's significant.
Okay. And where did this tradition of armed resistance come from? Is it, and I get related question, how specific is it to Mississippi?
Well, I think it's not just Mississippi, it's Southern. I think similar studies can be made in Louisiana, in Virginia, in Georgia, you know, other places in the South. It was just that when I began my study, I had so much data in Mississippi, I decided just to focus there. Or I could write several volumes on this question. So there are other examples of other places. I think there's a couple of things that converge to bring it together. I think one is you have authors like John Thornton and Walter Rucker, who written on African systems of tradition, of resistance, continuing with people who were brought here. Many of the captives who were brought here and who were enslaved here were actually soldiers in Africa, right? And they were captured and brought to the United States, which begins a martial tradition that goes inside of many of the rebellions that we saw in our early history here in the United States. So you have that tradition, but you also have a frontier tradition and also a tradition that citizenship was in early America, colonial and in the early decades of American citizenship or the American Republic, was considered gun ownership was attached to citizenship, and it was considered a right, particularly in a frontier tradition, and people relying upon weapons to defend themselves. And certainly, the South itself has that legacy, right? And so blacks were armed when they could, because oftentimes, you know, that there was an attempt going back to slavery to make sure black people didn't have guns. And so but I think with emancipation and with the pursuit of citizenship, Black people felt that they needed to be armed. And in that frontier traditions, for instance, you know, I interviewed some elders who said, and there, you know, there's a Black aspect to this. You know, not only do Black people have weapons to hunt, but for instance, I talked to some older women who said that their fathers taught them how to shoot because they were concerned about white rapists. And so it was seen as a means of survival. Outside of even thought of African continuity or influence, and even outside of the frontier tradition, is the people just looking at things basically to protect themselves in a hostile situation. And certainly American South was a hostile situation, a hostile environment for Black people during that period.
Mm-hmm. And is there also a rural component to this? Is this something that's particularly prominent in perhaps going along with the frontier tradition?
Right.
Particularly prominent in the rural
tradition, okay. You know, it's a rural situation. Mm-hmm. So people, when you don't have a state apparatus that is supposed to provide these things for citizens, it's not that widely, that's not that extensive, then people feel they have to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, yeah, it's connected to that. But in the Black situation, you also had the dynamic is even if you had that state apparatus, you can't depend upon it for protection.
Right. It might be worse to have that state apparatus
right.
there.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Every witness in the day.
Right. So after 64, going into 65 and beyond, as you already mentioned, the combination of a more active advocacy of armed resistance or the use of arms for activism, as well as economic campaigns, came together to be pretty effective. Could you talk a little bit about perhaps a particular campaign that you thought was effective or how that worked?
Okay, well, I think that strategy was developed in a place called Natchez, Mississippi. Natchez is in southwest Mississippi. Natchez prior to or during the antebellum period was the center of cotton. But when cotton spread through other parts of the state, and particularly the Mississippi Delta, the economy declined. And so Natchez became was reborn economically when you had several manufacturing industries move to Natchez, Mississippi in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, or really post-World War II period. And so when that happened, you had population coming to Natchez, black people and white people. And there were some people and there were some industries in which whites thought certain jobs should be reserved for white people. With that and with the populations coming there, Natchez had a very high concentration of Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist activity. It even led to 1963-64, there were several cases of assaults on black people there in Natchez, Mississippi. This kind of culminates in 1965, August of 1965, when one of the leaders of the NAACP, George Metcalf, who's working at the Armstrong Tire and Rubber Plant, he was asked to work overtime. He's also, I forgot to mention, he's also promoted to be a foreman, a job reserved for a white man. He goes to his car when he comes off his overtime shift. He turns on the ignition and the car explodes. Fortunately, he survived this explosion, but it was about to be a spontaneous uprising, which I call, but you know, some people call them riots. But, you know, a rebellion was about to occur. And the NAACP comes on the scene. Charles Evers, who was the state leader of the NAACP at that time, the brother of Medgar Evers, he said, the Negroes have taken all they could take. We're armed ourselves and you know, we're ready to fight back. When that occurs, around the same time, you have the development of this group called the Deacons for Defense. The Deacons had actually developed in Louisiana, but they had developed a group. There a group of deacons had developed in Natchez, Mississippi. And what I argue the Natchez model is his Everest call for economic boycott, which is one element, right? He also openly advocated armed resistance, which is another aspect of the model. The final piece of it was the use of a forces squad to make sure the black people did not break the boycott. And a gentleman by the name who moved to Mississippi from Cleveland, or really Chicago, by the name of Rudy Shields. He was the most effective organizer of these enforcer groups. But after you saw that boycott in Natchez, which was effective in getting basic demands for black people, you saw it in several parts of the state utilizing the same model. Sometimes you might not have the deacons, but it would be the threat of violence and or more aggressively armed black community. You would see it in places like Port Gibson, Mississippi, where there was a historic boycott documented by historian Emily Crosby in her book, Common Courtesy. You see it in several rural places. You see it in Fayette, Mississippi, which later became the home of Charles Evers. You see it in the Mississippi Delta in places like Belzoni and in Yazoo County. You see it all over the state. In fact, there were dozens of other boycotts that utilized this model. And I would argue that variations of this model were used from 1965 all the way through the late 70s, where you have an economic boycott, that you have black people no longer using nonviolent rhetoric, but using a rhetoric saying, if you attack us, we're going to attack you back, but also being more aggressively armed and more visibly armed.
Mm-hmm. And how long does this approach as a Natchez model continue to be a major part of activism of the black freedom struggle in Mississippi?
Like I said, from 1965 all the way through at least 1979,
okay.
You see it being used. The final place that I think you have major campaigns utilizing that strategy would be in northern Mississippi with the United League and places like Tupelo, where in 1978 and 79, Tupelo's, the home of Elvis Presley was shut down in terms of its financial district and commercial district. You would see it in places like Holly Springs, Mississippi. You would see it in Oklahoma, Mississippi, that model being used. I think it had significant effect, but I think somehow up until this book, historians have missed that pattern and seeing how effective it was as a social movement model for black people in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is? Why have we missed this pattern? Why don't we talk about it as much?
Well, I think until a recent trend of historians, people haven't looked at armed resistance as much. You have books like Tim Tyson's Radio Free Dixie. You have Lance Hill's Deacons for Defense. Of course, I mentioned Charles Cobb's book just recently come out. In my book, they kind of, or We Will Shoot Back, they kind of fit a new tradition among civil rights historians or movement historians who began to look and embrace armed resistance and look at its efficacy in the movement. It's not just some... It's just not something that happened on the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things I tried to do, We Will Shoot Back, this show wasn't exceptional. Because one of the arguments I made, even with people knowing about Robert Williams or the Deacons, sometimes people think about them as even exceptional, given what happened in the movement. But so I tried to show unsung people and people who are oftentimes attached with SNCC and CORE, but they're not well-known members. They're not spokespersons. They're just grassroots folks who kind of complemented their work on a local level. Mm-hmm. To show how this was actually connected to the actual culture of people in Mississippi. And so I think another thing, too, is the latest wave of historians, we've tended to look at the grassroots and local movement a little bit more. Works that precede mine, like John Dittmer's Local People or Charles Payne's I'm forgetting the name of his book right now. Charles Payne's book on the Mississippi Movement. I think they kind of opened the way for others of us, like Emily Crosby, like Hassan Jeffries, who looks at Alabama and looks at Lowndes County. It kind of opened the way for us to begin to look at things more from the bottom up, from the grassroots level. And then you kind of get a different perspective than when you're, if you're just talking about Dr. King. You know, that's a whole different element of the movement, right, who's approaching things maybe more from top down, and their national organizations come into local communities. We're actually looking at local people themselves. And I think there was a lot of change that happened locally. You know, some historians traditionally looked at major legislative change like the Voting Rights Act. So even when we see the movie Selma, it talks about a change that happened where the Voting Rights Act was implemented. But if you go to Selma today, a lot of people will tell you some of the same conditions in Selma exist today that existed in 1965, because there was this Voting Rights Act, but it, you know, the movement on a local level may be focused on these large demonstrations that got media attention, but they didn't focus on change on the ground, right? And change with the municipal government. So, you know, I think our this new wave kind of addresses that, and We Will Shoot Back kind of falls within that tradition.
Mm-hmm. So I have another question that's not the precise focus of your book, but you mention in the book that in the earlier debates within SNCC, for instance, that one of the arguments for nonviolence was sort of the optics of the movement, right? The way it will look for white liberals or to the North. Right. And of course, the media is a major part of nonviolence. So what did people think, or how visible was this type of action outside of Mississippi? How much did people in, I don't know, Illinois or Chicago or whatnot, know about what was happening in Natchez? Did it make a difference to them? Did armed resistance affect their opinion of the movement?
I think it only mostly might have made an impact through movement networks. And I think even prior to what we observe in Mississippi, for instance, when we talk about Robert Williams in North Carolina, there were a network of activists, black and white, usually more radical, who would begin to promote the work of his self-defense efforts to fight the Klan in North Carolina in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Similarly, when you had the activity happening, for instance, in Natchez, the Natchez Deacons, through their own networks, began to go to California and raise money. But there were more grassroots efforts. They didn't get promoted necessarily in Time magazine or the New York Times. New York Times might have mentioned some of the armed resistance activity, but it was more like, well, wow, this is a threat, because, you know, blacks are beginning to talk more about guns and, you know, in the South, and what's beginning to happen. But it wasn't like the same type of local or day-to-day coverage of their activities you might get, say, like from how the New York Times may have covered Martin Luther King. But through their grassroots efforts, they would get support, and blacks in other places would find out what they were doing, as well as it might have been communicated, particularly through aspects of the left. And so they would get support for their activities through that. Mm-hmm. I think that was where you might have some exceptions. For instance, Jet Magazine did cover the activities of the Deacons in Mississippi at several times. But again, as a researcher, too, this is what makes it a little bit more challenging for someone like me. I had to kind of dig deep. I had to interview people, mm-hmm. even find out about these things. I would make that argument.
Okay. And what about the Black Power movement in Mississippi and the other... I think you earlier called them more paramilitary organizations that are developing in the late 1960s as well. What was their role? How did they fit into the story?
Well, this aspect, actually, particularly if you talk about, as I mentioned, after 1965, and I think a lot of this is connected to In 1964, of course, you have Fannie Lou Hamer and others going to the Democratic Party convention, the national convention in Atlantic City, and trying to get support from the Democratic Party to seat the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And that doesn't happen, right? They only offered them two seats, which Fannie Lou and other grassroots leadership rejected. But it was kind of a signal that we can't really rely on the federal government. And this is coming behind years of SNCC activists, core activists in Mississippi asking for protection, requesting intervention from the federal government, and it not really happening to the level that they wanted it to happen. And so self-defense is kind of something that's embraced because people felt they had to rely on their own efforts to defend themselves. This sort of goes with the trend toward Black power, right? That Black people need to be more self-determining and relying upon their own resources, right? Rather than, as the term they would use at the time, begging the federal government to come down and do something for us. And so it was kind of consistent with that motion. So you have people who are part of that in Mississippi, Mr. Rudy Shields, who I mentioned earlier, and others becoming a part of this Mississippi orientation toward Black power. They continue to work on things in terms of voting rights. They continue to work on things in terms of Black electoral power. They continue to work on, even when it's desegregation of schools, okay, how can we, when we desegregate the schools, get Black administrative leadership in these schools? How can a Black community determine what's going to happen in our school system that fits our interests? Because, you know, when they desegregated a lot of times it didn't happen what was beneficial to Black communities or even Black educators. Finally, I think even in terms of education, the emphasis on identity, that we need to have Black studies, we need to have African-American history in our school for our children. So you do have this kind of Mississippi aspect of the Black power movement that begins to develop. And of course, defending oneself and defending the community was actually an aspect of that. So it happens in those ways. And another aspect is with a northern group who comes to Mississippi and that some Mississippi activists began to identify with, and that was the Republic of New Africa, who attempted to come to Mississippi work, in particularly in Black majority counties in Mississippi, to get some form of sovereignty and independence for Black people in those areas. Of course, it was shut down by the FBI, was brutally repressed. Christian Davenport just wrote a book on that that talks about the repression of the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa. But there were some local activists who identified with it. Some got involved and some just supported it and saw it as an ally to their movement there. So Black power, and I think that's another difference in We Will Shoot Back and some of the other books that looked at armed resistance in the South, is they really don't focus on the Black power period of the movement. I will also say that in Black power, there were some groups that looked to some aspect of guerrilla warfare, even that you saw develop in Mississippi during that period of time. So on a smaller level, not as broad as the armed resistance tradition, but it certainly existed. And so that was another aspect of Black power that was a part of Mississippi movement.
Okay. And how much connection, besides the group that you were just discussing, was there between the Black power in Mississippi and all of the strains you were just talking about and Black power activists in California or in northern urban areas?
The only place I saw it really had, well, a couple of connections. First is, you had the Revolutionary Action Movement, which is really in the early period, 1964, before we had traditionally have what we have Black power, talk about Black power, is they attempted to set up networks and improve those networks we talked about before that would support armed resistance in the South. And they tried to raise money and whatever and set up a connection where people from the North would support them. But in the Republic of New Africa, but then you had other groups who really didn't look at the South, particularly the rural South, as strategic. So, for instance, Rudy Shields, who we mentioned earlier, corresponded and attempted to get Huey Newton of the Black Panther Party to come to Mississippi on a couple of occasions and got no response because many of the northern Black Power activists are looking at the north. They're looking at urban centers. They're looking at, you know, Oakland. They're looking at South Central Los Angeles. They're looking at Harlem. And they're not really that much concerned about what's happening in Mississippi. So when you had folks reach out, they didn't get that response, with the exception of the Republic of New Africa, who saw Mississippi as central. Mm-hmm. And so they began to move people there and things of that nature. But the FBI didn't allow them to exist long enough to organize the area. I mean, they still exist in name today, but not in the same dynamic way that they existed in 1971.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens to these movements?
I argue that particularly with blacks getting electoral power, because even in the early 70s, you can see that there wasn't a lot of advance in terms of the Voting Rights Act. But when black people begin to elect mayors, when they elect sheriffs, there wasn't seen to be a need for these armed groups as you had prior to that. So that's one of the things that begins to happen. There is also the element of repression against some movements. And so you have some people, for instance, the Republic of New Africa, that even included a few local people, were political prisoners for a particular period of time. And I think just with the attack on resources, some movements, you just had cynicism develop over a period of time. But you have all these things. So the movements didn't exist in the same dynamic way by mid-70s as they did in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. Like, with the exception, I argue, of the United League of Mississippi, which existed until 1979-80, and then it began to crumble, I think, because of division within the movement itself, I would argue, that it began to decline in terms of its influence because of its own internal contradictions.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, as you started out, you talk about yourself as a scholar activist, and I assume you teach as well. Right. In your position. So I'm curious if you might talk a little bit about how this scholarship influences those other two roles for you. How does this influence the way you teach? I mean, I'm sure, of course, you teach about Mississippi and what happened in Mississippi, right, but how it influences the way you and other historians might teach about the broader idea of the civil rights movement, how it should change our narrative, how it influences your activism as well.
Well, in terms of my teaching, how I explore it with my students is we look at the historiography, right? We look at how it was previously looked at in terms of armed resistance, how it's changed. And then I might challenge the students to look at competing narratives and evaluate them themselves and see what the if there is a change in the narrative, how do the sources influence the change, right? And so we look at it in that way. So they can begin to look for sources in other areas that might change how we look at things. But the importance of the sources and what the sources are saying and how we interpret the sources. So that's one way as a teacher, just to teach them exactly what I felt I did, right? Number two, in terms of my activism, what I do, I know I was just in a conversation the other day with Ferguson happening today, with Baltimore happening, and then with the spontaneous rebellions that occurred there, the question, well, how do nonviolent activists relate to this? And so we look at how there was tension before, but how there was complementarity. We also look at, you know, sometimes people condemn the spontaneous rebellions, and I show them historically how, for instance, in my book, we talk about a bombing campaign that existed in Macomb, Mississippi in 1964. And in that bombing campaign, there was a dynamiting campaign that was done by the Ku Klux Klan, or a section of the Ku Klux Klan. The federal government didn't seem to respond to it like it was serious. Why do I say that? Because there was there was a, what do you call it, a contingent of 12 FBI agents in Macomb that in the midst of the bombing campaign, it was dropped to 4. And it was only after a spontaneous uprising in Macomb that President Johnson called the leaders of Macomb to come meet with him, and they were able to arrest the Ku Klux Klansmen within 7 days of that meeting. But it was only after the spontaneous rebellion was this seen by the federal government as something serious. So one of the things I argue to people today is when people condemn people who are spontaneously fighting and rebelling is, no, we don't condemn that. As Martin Luther King said, this is the language of the unheard. These people just haven't been organized before, and maybe they could do something a little bit more effectively if they were organized. But no, they're unheard. Let's recognize them for that and try to organize people. And it doesn't have to be worse. It's in competition with people who are doing nonviolent resistance. In fact, the argument I make is some of the nonviolent resistance we see in a place like Ferguson became spontaneous rebellion because they were attacked by police, right? People with tear gas and things of that nature. And they're just trying to survive out there and make sure that they can make it to the next day. So I think it's a call, should be a call. My research informs it should be a call for more organization of grassroots people to have more effective resistance, like we saw in the Natchez model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I teach in Texas in an area that's relatively conservative, and there's not a lot of activism. And I think oftentimes when I'm teaching about movements and teaching about civil rights and teaching about even earlier sorts of Black activism, often students often they wonder if some of the violence inflicted on activists is sort of brought upon activists by right. their own activity. And I think this is a really interesting way to answer that question, or a really great body of research to say, look, it's not the case that nonviolent activists get results and people who have used any sort of armed resistance or anything like that don't, right? That seems to right. often be the image that my students have when they're in my class. And I think this provides a really, really good way to respond to that. Because that's always a question that I struggle with, how to answer, to say, no, that's not exactly right. the image, but I don't always have quite the perfect examples to give to them.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for contributing that.
Yeah. So we've taken up a lot of your time. So our traditional last question is, what are you working on now?
Well, what I'm working on now, actually, I'm working on several projects. But one of them is extending from Mississippi as and one of the people who helped me with the book and actually provided the cover for the book was Chokwe Lumumba, who was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. He was elected mayor in spring of 2013, but he passed 8 months after his election. He had a very progressive orientation. In fact, he ran for city council in 2009, and his platform came from a people's assembly he formed in his ward. And so he was promoting this concept of a people's assembly citywide. And then finally, they were pushing the development of economic cooperatives in Mississippi, particularly in Jackson, because, you know, Mississippi is one of the poorest states in the United States. And so, but he passed. So I'm writing a book. Chokwe was a progressive attorney, and he was also an activist himself. So I'm writing I'm collecting his speeches and writings to pick the best of them to do an edited volume, but I'm also working with some other scholars to do interpretations of his contribution, particularly around his political administration, but his work even prior to that. So we're looking at doing an edited volume on his work, and I'm also working with some folks on a political biography of Chokwe Lumumba. Finally, I'm working on with Dr. Karen Stafford and Jasmine Young. We're working on an encyclopedia of Black power, So those are some of the projects. I have several others I'm working on. I'm 60 years old, so I'm trying to get it done while I still can.
Sounds like you're very busy then.
Yeah, trying not to be idle.
Very good. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.